Thank you one more time for that introduction. And let me, a couple things just to say at the start. Let me just say first that I've enjoyed being here. It's been very nice. Never been here before. I've been sort of through Louisville, but never to the seminary. And it was good. You're fortunate. You should be grateful for where you are. And I enjoyed it. The other thing I'd say is I called my wife yesterday. I always, when I'm gone somewhere, I generally check in with her under the illusion that she needs to hear from me, sort of. It turns out that this woman in Valparaiso, Indiana, who is a lifelong Lutheran, is wondering whether she should actually become a Southern Baptist because she told me that yesterday she got a delivery from a florist, a nice big bouquet of beautiful sunflowers, and the little card, you know, those cards that come with those things. I don't remember exactly what it said, but it said something like, Mrs. Mylander, thank you for sharing your husband with us for these several days. It came from the seminary. I don't know who's responsible for sending it, though whoever it is should get a raise, in my wife's opinion. You know, I've talked a lot of places on a lot of occasions over the years, and as she said on the phone, nobody ever sent her flowers before just because I talked there. And so my wife thanks you also. It was very nice. A kind of introductory word before I really launch into what I'm up to, because I want to prepare you for the fact that of the three lectures I'm giving, This is by far, I think, the most theoretical and conceptual. So, you know, you're going to have to work to hang with me a little bit. But I don't want you to think it's theory just for the sake of theory. It actually grows out of some sort of practical concerns. And I just, in very brief form, explain what those are. When I served on the President's Council on Bioethics for almost 8 years, the first report that the council brought out was titled Human Cloning and Human Dignity. So that language of dignity was right in the title of the report. Well, actually, if you read the report, it doesn't appeal to the concept of dignity that often, but it was right there. And then we used the language of dignity somewhat in a second report as well. And the council's work was criticized by some people for having used the language of dignity without really analyzing it, without really articulating what exactly that meant. And, I mean, there was some legitimacy to that criticism, and that set me to thinking about it because it's not, in fact, easy to clarify. It's the kind of language that gets appealed to in bioethics quite frequently, but just appealed to, and does need some clarification. It was the occasion for several long conversations I had with Leon Cass, who was the chairman of the council, and we found it to be a subject on which, though he and I agree on a great many things, on this subject our emphases were a little different, and probably ultimately for some theological reasons. But at least in my experience, when Leon Cass thinks you're mistaken, you do need to think for a while. You don't just assume you're right. So I went to work on it. I've thought it through several times, tried to kind of rework what I thought about it. And I've come to the point, which I'm going to try to develop now at some length, where I try to distinguish between two notions of dignity. I mean, it's not one bad and one good, but two notions that are just different, one of which I'm going to call human dignity and the other I'm going to call personal dignity. I'll try to explain what that means. Although the effort is a kind of theoretical one to sort out what we mean here, it grows out of actually some very practical concerns. This is language that's commonly appealed to in bioethics and appealed to in different ways. And that's where I want to start, just by noting the different ways it can be used. Now, I think, in fact, if you pay attention in bioethics, you'll see that this happens. So here's an example. The phrase death with dignity has become a sort of slogan in our country, used by people who want to support assisted suicide or euthanasia. So, for instance, a rather well-known man named Dr. Timothy Quill, in an essay describing how he helped a patient of his to commit suicide, wrote this. I wrote the prescription for this patient. I wrote the prescription with an uneasy feeling about the boundaries I was exploring. Yet I also felt strongly that I was setting her free to get the most out of the time she had left and to maintain dignity and control on her own terms until death. Okay? There's one use of dignity. Here's a second. Ira Byock, he's a well-known hospice physician who's written a good bit in bioethics, but he writes, and notice what a different slant he has on it. He writes, "Most of us will be physically dependent and intimately cared for by others before we die. This fact does not destine us to become undignified. It simply confirms that we are human." Now, when you can get a word used in such diametrically opposed ways, roughly the same kind of context, it's probably time for us to stop and think just a little bit about it. Not just about the word, I mean, don't care too much about the word, but about the deeper questions that underlie it. And so I want first just to try to sort of unpack what I think are kind of two somewhat different notions of dignity that are at work in our thinking. It was Kierkegaard who really first set me to thinking about this, though Kierkegaard didn't write about bioethics. As some of you may know, Kierkegaard published a whole lot of works under various pseudonyms, all sorts of peculiar pseudonyms, and he published a lot of other works under his own name. In fact, that fact about his writing has produced a whole little cottage industry that will keep Kierkegaard scholars busy forever trying to figure out what the significance of the pseudonyms is and so forth. But when Kierkegaard himself explained, as much as he did explain, this somewhat confusing mixture of works published under different names, he distinguished two different senses in which his work focused on what he called the single individual. And he said that in the works written under the various pseudonyms, the individual whom he has in mind is what he calls a distinguished person. Distinguished, that is, by human excellence of one sort or another. But in the writings that he published under his own name, which he called edifying or upbuilding works, the individual is, he says, what every man is or can be. So the single individual can mean the one and only, the truly excellent one, or it can mean each one of us, whatever condition we may be. So then suppose we say that someone has dignity or displays dignity. We could mean either of these things and might in different contexts. We could mean that he is an especially distinguished person, distinguished by some sort of human excellence that though we may all share to some degree, he has in greater degree, sets him off from the rest of us. Or we could mean that in him we see the dignity that belongs to all of us. We could mean either of those things and might, but they're quite different ideas, and they may have rather different implications under different circumstances. Now, I'm going to call the first of them human dignity, those human excellences which we will all have to some degree, but in greater or lesser degrees, and I'm going to call the second personal dignity. There's nothing sacred about the language, okay? I actually have some reasons for it, which I'm not going to bother you with, I'm not going to the wall for the language. It's the concepts that I'm interested in. We need some way to mark the distinction. So that from one perspective, human beings are members of a species. That species is distinguished from other species by certain sort of characteristics and modes of life. Human beings, in fact, are, as I called them yesterday, a sort of strange in-between kind of creature, lower than angels or gods, higher than beasts, not just body, not just mind, but it's this strange kind of conjunction of mind and spirit. So as St. Augustine puts it in a very succinct sentence that captures the point, he says, God created man's nature as a kind of mean between angels and beasts. And human beings of this sort display certain characteristics then that make them different, set them off from the other animals, though some of us will have these in greater degrees than others. That's our human dignity, the characteristics that set us off and distinguish the human person. It's not bad. We should not ignore that human dignity. To the best of our ability, we should honor it and uphold it. And we honor it by trying to be neither more than human, as if we were gods, nor less than human, as if we were just animals. Now, neither of those natures is a bad thing. An animal's not a bad thing. Angel's not a bad thing. But we're neither. We're something different. And human dignity is to be found in the kind of life that expresses and exemplifies and honors and upholds the particular nature that is ours, even if there is perhaps no precise recipe to tell us how to do that. That's one kind of dignity that we often find ourselves referring to. But other times, I think, when we use, you may ultimately disagree, but other times when we use the language of dignity, we mean something different, what I'm calling personal dignity. Sometimes what we want to emphasize in particular is the equal standing of each individual person. And that equal standing, if it exists, if it actually does exist, cannot be grounded in any of those particular characteristics that distinguish human beings from other species, because those other characteristics we possess unequally in greater or lesser degrees. We have these human characteristics, but not necessarily in the same measure. So that we are committed to a belief in equal personal dignity, though the ground of that belief may be a little mysterious, and I'm eventually going to work my way toward thinking about that mystery. But there are circumstances, various circumstances, in which I think actually if you just analyzed your own thinking or speaking, you'd see that we find it quite natural to think in terms of these two kinds of dignity. We might not use my particular language, might not even pay attention, but I think we do. I want to give you three examples of this, okay, because this has been kind of abstract up till now. Let me put a little flesh on the bones of that. Three examples of how the two kinds of dignity might be appealed to in similar circumstances. Here's the first. Suppose a cloned human being were born, which is a possibility that we've at least had to think about and reckon with since the sheep Dolly, the cloning of the sheep Dolly was announced in 1997. Suppose that happened. Now, lots of people, whether they can exactly articulate their reasons or explain why they feel this way or whatever, but lots of people think that were that to happen, such an event would diminish or degrade human dignity. They say that, you know, that would in some way, there's something wrong about that that would diminish human dignity. And yet many of those very same people, if you ask them whether such a newly cloned person, if there were such, person on the scene, if you ask them whether such a newly cloned person deserves respect as our equal or is really one of us or, as it's sometimes been put, has a soul, most of those people would not hesitate to answer yes. So on the one hand, they'd say producing such a person degrades human dignity. On the other hand, well, that person would be our equal. And would be one of us. So that it seems as if one can believe both that cloning would undermine the dignity that characterizes our humanity and that a cloned human being would be our equal in the dignity that inheres in every person. It seems as if, I mean, I think actually, as I say, if you thought about it, you might find yourself thinking in that way. That's one example that just would at least make it seem that this is not a bizarre distinction that I'm making, but that there's something to it. Here's a second example. This is a very different kind of example, but you'll see, again, in a very different context how something similar may happen. In a book in which he was discussing the morality of capital punishment, a man named Walter Burns, who's a political philosopher, Burns quoted a statement from the former Supreme Court Justice William Brennan. And in the statement, in one of Brennan's opinions, he had written, "Even the vilest criminal remains a human being possessed of human dignity." And Burns quotes this statement from Brennan and then disagrees with it emphatically. Okay, and when I read you his disagreement here, I think you'll agree that it's emphatic. In fact, this is what Burns wrote. "What sort of humanism is it that respects equally the life of Thomas Jefferson and Charles Manson, Abraham Lincoln and Adolf Eichmann, Martin Luther King and James Earl Ray? To say that these men, some great and some unspeakably vile, equally possess human dignity is to demonstrate an inability to make a moral judgment derived from or based on the idea of human dignity." Okay, so Burns clearly disagrees. Now, we understand what he means when he says it. I mean, they're rather striking examples, in fact, that he gives. And in certain moods, you know, on certain occasions, we might be inclined to agree. You can see how you might, on one occasion or another, feel drawn to agree. And yet, I myself think that the more striking inability displayed in that passage is Burns' own inability to find any standpoint from which to see what we might call the whole truth about any and every human life, and especially when life and death are at stake, as they are in his example, and I'm going to come back to that later, especially when life and death are at stake, when we're forced to think about a person's life as a whole and to try to see it as a whole, the distinctions that we make in other contexts and need to make in other contexts may lose some of their force. To respect the dignity of a person who has done great evil, who may have diminished or demeaned the human dignity that he shares with us, is not an easy task. And yet, if you think about it, our very willingness to try to give such a person a fair trial, and puzzling as it may seem sometimes even, our willingness to hold such a person responsible and to punish him depends on our continued affirmation of the dignity of his person, even while he has subverted the human dignity that he shares with us. That's my second example. Here's a third. One of them should click for you somewhere along the way. See, that's the way I feel. I might say that chattel slavery, buying and selling another human being, I might say that that degrades and dehumanizes the slave, depriving him of his human dignity. I might also say that nothing you can do to a person, including enslaving him, can deprive him of his dignity. I might say both of those things. And you can even imagine somebody giving a talk against slavery, getting all worked up and saying, making both of those statements in very close proximity to each other. I don't think such a speaker would be confused or would be contradicting himself. May it not be the case that slavery, on the one hand, degrades the human dignity of the slave and yet is utterly unable to deprive him of the personal dignity that he shares with each of us? So that, you know, both of those make a certain kind of sense. On the one hand, the language of human dignity serves as what you might call just a placeholder for a whole large set of ideas. It's a placeholder for a very complex vision of what it means to be a human being, a humanity that is subverted if we think of human beings simply as animated commodities capable of being owned by others. And on the other hand, the language of dignity also affirms that we would be wrong to suppose that among two people made equally for life with God, one could be the owner of the other. And so we could coherently, I think, coherently object to slavery, both on the ground that it deprives the slave of his human dignity and on the ground that it fails to recognize the personal dignity that slave still has. Both of those make sense. The human person is a member of our species. That species has a range of special characteristics, but that person is not just a something, not just a bearer of certain kinds of qualities or capacities. He or she is also a someone, occupying a unique place that transcends species membership. Now, that's mysterious, and yet I think it's true. The person is marked by what the philosopher John Crosby has called an incommunicability or an innate unrepeatability. Now, why that should be needs a little thought, but it's true, I believe. So let me turn to try to think about it a little bit. What the ground of this equal personal dignity is, and some of the puzzles it raises. The idea of the equal dignity of every person, whatever differences in our capacities may be, whatever our virtues or vices, this is not just a contemporary idea. We may think of this, and the language is mostly kind of contemporary, but it's not just a contemporary idea. It's true that in the classical world of Greece and Rome, dignity was generally an aristocratic concept. Have dignity was to be a special sort of person, to want to be a really excellent person, referred to those of high social status or those marked by excellence of one sort or another. It's still true, however, that even in that classical world, Stoic thinkers, for instance, did have an idea of a dignity that inhered in the individual, abstracted from all particular characteristics or social roles. And the idea of that equal personal dignity, though not necessarily the term or the language, has certainly been present in a lot of Christian thought, whatever failings in practice Christians may have had. Christian thought has taught an equal respect for each person as one made for covenant community with God. So, for instance, the short little prayer called a collect, the short little prayer for the first Sunday after Christmas in the Lutheran Book of Worship, which I thought we should read something from here. Before we were done, that short little prayer begins, Almighty God, you wonderfully created and yet more wonderfully restored the dignity of human nature. I mean, it's a standard Christian claim, whether the language of dignity precisely has been used or not. And I myself think that it grows less out of some complicated set of beliefs and more out of just certain fundamental Christian stories that are embedded in the Christian imagination, the stories that are right at the heart of Christian belief. So, for instance, we can, I think, hardly overestimate the power of the Christmas story, God as a baby in a manger, weak, vulnerable, so forth. We can hardly overestimate the power of that story to shape our culture's understanding of the dignity of every person, however weak or vulnerable those persons may be. I think there's a kind of insight in the words of the well-known Christmas carol, O Holy Night. At one point it says, long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. See, that worth of the individual's dignity. And at least as powerful as the Christmas story in shaping this this understanding of the dignity of every person has been the picture of God dying on a cross, God as weak and vulnerable. And in the theologian David Cairns, in an old but still useful book that was called The Image of God in Man, once told a story that captures this. It's another one of these no doubt legendary stories, but it makes the point. It's a story about a scholar named Muratus, medieval scholar, at a time when scholars all spoke Latin, who in the 16th century was ill, very severely ill, and his doctors were going to try an operation on him, or so the story goes. But the truth of the matter is, and of course, you know, you don't actually want to know what surgery in the 16th century was like. The truth of the matter was they didn't expect this really to help him in any way. They were more interested just in seeing kind of what happened when they did it and how he'd die, you know, what the symptoms would be and so forth. So that in a certain sense, they were really thinking of it less as what we'd call therapy and more as a kind of experiment. That was really what they were thinking of. But according to the story anyway, they didn't know who this patient was lying on this bed before them. Didn't know that he was a learned scholar and so forth. And not knowing who he was or that he spoke Latin, one of the doctors said to the other, "Fiat experimentum in corpora vili. Let the experiment be tried on this vile body." Okay, and then the voice from the bed before them said, "Vilem animan appellas pro qua Christus non dedignatus est mori." Do you call that soul vile for which Christ was content to die? Well, I mean, it's the power, you see, of that story. It's less some complicated teaching of theologians and more just the power of those narratives that has embedded itself in Christian imagination in a way that I think has been at the heart of that understanding of equal personal dignity. Now, in the modern age, there's been a kind of with that Christian heritage of some sort. There's been a kind of increasing democratization in our general culture of the idea of personal dignity, but at the same time, the religious ground of it that I think was there originally, the religious ground has become increasingly attenuated. It's become just less obvious in the minds of many people, even as we're committed to an increasing democratization of the idea of dignity. And in the late 1940s, just after the Second World War, when UNESCO for the United Nations was in the process of developing what has come to be called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, UNESCO had convened a committee of philosophers, which may always be a bad idea, of course, but had convened a committee of philosophers to examine the theoretical bases for universal claims about human rights and dignity. They were supposed to kind of work together on this from different countries and cultures and so forth. And it turned out that this group of philosophers were able to agree on a lot of particular claims about one right or another, you know, that sort of thing. But they were, perhaps unsurprisingly, unable to agree at all on why those particular claims were true, what the ground or the basis for them was. Unable, that is, to develop any shared vision of human nature or of the human person that would explain on what those claims were based. And Jacques Maritain, the well-known Roman Catholic philosopher, who was one of the participating philosophers on this committee, later recounted how, as he put it, at one of the meetings of a UNESCO National Commission where human rights were being discussed, someone expressed astonishment that certain champions of violently opposed ideologies had agreed on a list of those rights. Yes, they said, we agree about the rights, but on condition that no one asks us why. Because we can't tell. We just don't know what the basis. And similarly, but more recently, in a very fine book called Our Post-Human Future, Francis Fukuyama, who's a well-known scholar in this country, Fukuyama goes to work on the concept of personal dignity, and he's looking for the ground of it. In other words, if we all share this equal personal dignity, why? What's the ground of it? What makes us share it? And he's looking for some sort of essential characteristic that will serve as the ground. But alas, most of the things you hit upon, we share unequally, as I said before. There are aspects of what I call human dignity, and we have them in varying degrees and so forth. But Fukuyama committed to the belief in equal personal dignity, which our tradition has given us and which we still want to maintain, is convinced it must be there. And so he finally is forced to call this underlying ground that accounts for this equal personal dignity factor X. That is to say, you know, he thinks there must be some essential quality underlying all those differences between us that makes it reasonable to speak of our equal dignity, so that factor X accounts for that equal dignity, even though he cannot quite say what it actually is. And so this is sort of where we are in our culture, I think. The way I put it is, say, we have something of a puzzle. We have a commitment, which we don't want to give up on. We have a commitment in search of a rationale. We don't know what the rationale is any longer. Now, there are serious questions, perhaps, about how long a commitment that is just in search of a rationale can survive if it doesn't find it, but that's where we are. Now, what can Christians say about this? We do not want to discard the inequalities that are built into what I call human dignity. They play an important role in life. It is obvious that for certain purposes and in certain contexts, we do make distinctions among human beings. We make distinctions of merit among human beings. I've been grading student papers for a long time. Not always a pleasant experience. And one of the things is, it's tedious, actually, in a lot of ways. Sorry, students. But one of the things that's unpleasant about it has nothing to do with the tedium. It has to do with the fact that it's not always pleasant to make those distinctions, you see. I may not find you to be a very pleasant person at all, and you write an A paper for me, and there may be a really nice student in class, and quite frankly, it's just a C, you know. We make these distinctions, and we must. Academic institutions are a fine example of something that's meritocratic. And must be. An academic or a class in which every student got an A, even though that would be welcomed, you know, in some ways by some students, and actually in this age of course evaluations welcomed by some faculty also. But it would be understood to subvert the very nature of the undertaking. You know, it's not what we're up to. And you don't have, there are other examples. The worlds of sport and of musical performance, though very different in a lot of ways, are both arenas in which we still strive for excellence and we watch with an eye to discerning that excellence. We make comparative judgments and assessments all the time. We look for performances that strike us as especially accomplished in different ways. And we generally think, or at least hope, that an eye for those differences and accomplishments, that making those comparative assessments, need not undercut our commitment to the equal dignity of human persons. And I think it need not, but we always have to be alert to and keep in mind the difference between thinking about the dignity that's characteristic of the human species and the way we are unequal in that in various ways, and the dignity inhering in each person. And we need to let our sense of those differences and distinctions in excellence be permeated by an eye for the dignity of the person that is also there. Kierkegaard makes this point really beautifully. I'm going to read you a short passage. This is from his Works of Love. And he writes, this is sort of a typical Kierkegaard kind of passage. He writes, "Suppose that there are two artists, and one of them says, 'I have traveled much and seen much in the world, but I have sought in vain to find a person worth painting. I have found no face that was the perfect image of beauty to such a degree that I could decide to sketch it. In every face I have seen one or another little defect, and therefore I seek in vain.' Would this be a sign that this artist is a great artist? The other artist, however, says, 'Well, I do not actually profess to be an artist. I have not traveled abroad either, but stay at home with the little circle of people who are closest to me, since I have not found one single face to be so insignificant or so faulted that I still could not discern a more beautiful side and discover something transfigured in it. That is why, without claiming to be an artist, I am happy in the art I practice and find it satisfying. Would this not be a sign that he is indeed the artist? He who, by bringing a certain something with him, found right on the spot what the well-traveled artist did not find anywhere in the world, perhaps because he did not bring a certain something with him. Therefore, the second of the two would be the artist." It's a nice passage. But recognizes something that's true, that this, what I'm calling this equal dignity of persons, will not always seem obvious to us. And perhaps, I only say perhaps here, but perhaps we will see it only insofar as we bring a certain something with us, as Kierkegaard put it. And for Kierkegaard, that certain something was very specifically the neighbor love that Christians are enjoined to show to every human being made for community with God. And that neighbor love, echoing God's own love, underlies our commitment to personal dignity. Now, I myself doubt, and I don't want to put it any stronger than that, but I doubt whether there is any way to derive a commitment to equal respect for every human being from the ordinary distinctions in merit and excellence that we all use in some spheres of life, you know, that whole package of traits that make up human dignity, as I've called it. I think that this commitment to equal respect is grounded rather not in our relation to each other, but in our relation to God. Relation to God from whom, to use a mathematical metaphor, we are equidistant. And so as Kierkegaard again puts it, the thought of God's presence makes a person modest in relation to another person because the presence of God makes the two essentially equal. See, it's precisely what I quoted before, what the philosopher John Crosby calls the innate unrepeatability of persons that makes it impossible to evaluate persons comparatively. And that impossibility, the fact that we can't evaluate them comparatively, establishes in turn a certain kind of equality among us. So to say that our concept of human dignity must be thoroughly permeated by a recognition of personal dignity is important. It's not to say that we should only make those judgments about equal personal dignity. Both kinds of judgments are necessary in life, as I pointed out. I mean, we need those comparative assessments on some occasions as well. How to hold the two together, I wish I could really answer that question for you. It's not clear to me that we can fully sort it out. Between these two concepts of what I'm calling human dignity and personal dignity, there's some kind of dialectical relationship, though I'm conscious of the fact when I say that when theologians and philosophers appeal to the word dialectical, they're really saying we haven't got the foggiest idea exactly how this works. It's just dialectical. But in some way, each needs the other to supplement its central concern. We need the language of human dignity to talk about matters that involve the integrity and the flourishing of the human species, what makes for really human excellence, you know, that we strive for. And we need the language of personal dignity to express respect for persons regarded as equal and non-interchangeable individuals. We use the language of dignity, the word dignity, actually for both of those on various occasions, but we're often doing two quite different kinds of talk. So that the language of human dignity points to qualities that characterize and distinguish human life, and it will always be true that some individuals possess more of those qualities or possess them in more developed ways than others. Comparative judgments will always be possible. Some of us just flourish more than others in our lives, showing more fully what a kind of excellent, what a human being at his best can be. So that the concept of human dignity just invites comparative assessments. And, of course, then those comparative assessments will suggest that some of us have more of that human dignity than others, display more of it, and some of us may have lost it almost entirely. Now, against the dangers of such comparison, you know, in dialectical relationship, we need the notion of personal dignity. It provides a kind of protection against those dangers, asserting what will not always seem obvious, the equal dignity of persons. And, of course, it in turn, by affirming our equal dignity, may sometimes seem to undermine all those distinctions of lesser or greater, or better or worse that we routinely make, you know, as if I just shouldn't pass out those grades any longer. So that we need the idea of human dignity still to articulate what it means for a human being to live well, to strive to live well. Now, as I said, I doubt whether there is any perfect formula that can tell us how to hold these two together properly in our thinking and our doing. We're still trying to hold them together in our society, though if I'm right in what I said before, we're kind of living off the capital of a Christian notion that that most people can't work out in anything more than a factor X kind of way any longer. But if we allow... If we allow our understanding of human dignity to be shaped by our commitment to personal dignity, then we won't be moved only by surface differences, even important surface differences. We'll be a little more like Kierkegaard's second artist, whose eye is attuned to the deeper truth that lies beneath those surfaces. And then finally, I should warn you, I mean, when I say finally, I do not mean that 60 seconds from now I'm going to be done. It's going to take me a little longer than that. I think that this non-comparative sense of personal dignity, as I've called it, this non-comparative sense becomes especially important in human life when we make what you might call on-the-whole judgments about a person's life. And, of course, there's a moment when on-the-whole judgments necessarily are made, and that's the moment of death. We are unable to transcend entirely our particular location in time and space. We never see anybody's life, including our own, from God's perspective. So we never see anybody's life quite on the whole. But we need to try, therefore, always to think of other persons, not in simply in themselves, but rather as they stand with us in relation to God. And in that relation to God, we are most radically equal in those moments when our life is judged on the whole, as only God sees it. That's when so many of the other differences melt away. The one place where this is most obvious is at the point of death. There's a wonderful passage from G.K. Chesterton that captures the sense in which these other differences seem to become less important, and each of us is singular and unique at that point. I won't read you it's a rather long passage. I'll just read you the crucial part, and it's funny in a classically Chestertonian kind of way. But he's talking about how when we think of the human being dying, how these other things that in certain other moments are very important lose their importance. He talks about what he calls the democratic emotion. And he says, it is a certain instinctive attitude which feels that the things in which all men agree are unspeakably important, and all the things in which they differ, such as mere brains, are almost unspeakably unimportant. The nearest approach to it in our ordinary life would be the promptitude with which we should consider mere humanity in any circumstance of shock or death. We should say, after a somewhat disturbing discovery, there is a dead man under the sofa. We would not be likely to say, there is a dead man of considerable personal refinement under the sofa. We should say, a woman has fallen into the water. We should not say, a highly educated woman has fallen into the water. Nobody would say, there are the remains of a clear thinker in your back garden. Nobody would say, unless you hurry up and stop him, a man with a very fine ear for music will have jumped off that cliff. In those circumstances, all those other things, which are very important in some other settings, lose their importance. And Chesterton gets it just right. Now, it may be good for the species. I mean, a lot of people say, it's a complicated question, but it may be good or even necessary for the species in some way that each of us die. That's a common thing to say. At the very least, it does seem clear that nature doesn't care to invest a lot in keeping us around once we've reproduced. That does seem to be a fact. But whatever we say about that, your death or my death is not simply good. Because of the innate unrepeatability that each of us is. So that a husband who has lost his wife mourns, and he should mourn. One of his deepest human attachments, perhaps the deepest, has been severed. He can remarry, of course. Lots of older men do. As my wife says, they need to be taken care of. But he can remarry, but he cannot simply replace his wife with another and in that way repair the loss. Parents who have lost a child to death can have another child, but they cannot simply replace the one who's died, and it's very sad that sometimes parents don't realize that, in fact. Ralph McInerney, philosopher Ralph McInerney, himself, who himself died about maybe 2 years ago, a very fine Roman Catholic philosopher, McInerney put the point this way. He wrote, "The point of a proper name is that it is not common to many, and yet many people do bear identical names. But even when two persons have the same proper name, it does not become a common noun like man. All the John Smiths that have been, are, and will be have nothing in common but the name. It does not name something common to them all. God calls us all by our proper name, and he is unlikely to confuse one John Smith with another." I mean, God can deal with that innate unrepeatability. So that each of us is singled out equally as one whom God knows by name. And that means that death takes from us a unique and irreplaceable person. And in that sense, however natural in some other sorts of ways death may be, however natural a part of life it may be, it is always also what St. Paul called it. It's an enemy. And we cannot simply embrace it as a friend. Now, how this sort of dual, twofold perspective on dignity and death works itself out in particular instances in life and at the end of life, that's a complicated question. But in a sense, this twofold perspective was underlying my attempt to talk about those end-of-life issues yesterday. I've just saved the theory for the end, in a way. Getting the theory right will not magically solve every hard question that comes along, but it gives us the context and the framework in which to do our thinking. On the one hand, death is the natural end to human life. Other people come along to replace us. Maybe that's good for the species, get some new ideas. And whatever we say about that, we do need to find a way to accept that in the world that we live in now, this is the trajectory of human life. Our lives begin in dependence, and they probably, in many cases, end in dependence after a period of decline. That's not contrary to human dignity. That's part of characteristic human life. It's part of what it means to have human dignity. But on the other hand, each of us also is the bearer of a personal dignity bestowed by God, so that you cannot be replaced. The problem is that so far as we can discern, so far as the unaided human eye can discern, death seems to cut off that unique, irreplaceable person that is you, or that is me, one who cannot simply be replaced by the next generation that comes along. So there comes a time when we must acknowledge death, recognize it, permit it to happen, but never a time when we can simply and without any qualification just call it good. Can't do that. That two-sided perspective, that twofold understanding of our dignity is grounded in what I called yesterday that strange two-sidedness of our nature, created as we are from the dust of the ground, but animated by the breath of God. And only as we learn to think in both of these ways will we manage to think about death and, of course, about life in ways that do justice to our dignity, both human and personal. Thank you very much.